This episode is brought to you by Thorn, and I have some incredible news for any of you that are in the military, first responder, or medical professions. In an effort to give back, Thorn is now offering you an ongoing 35% off each and every one of your purchases of their incredible nutritional solutions. Now, Thorn is the official supplement of CrossFit, the UFC, the Mayo Clinic, the Human Performance Project, and multiple special operations organizations. I myself have used them for several years, and that is why I brought them on as a sponsor. Some of my favorite products they have are their Multivitamin Elite, their Whey Protein, the Super EPA, and then most recently, Cinequil. As a firefighter, a stuntman, and a martial artist, I've had my share of brain trauma and sleep deprivation, and Cinequil is their latest brain health supplement. Now, to qualify for the 35% off, go to thorn.com, thorne.com. Click on sign in and then create a new account. You will see the opportunity to register as a first responder or member of military. When you click on that, it will take you through verification with GovX. You'll simply choose a profession, provide one piece of documentation, and then you are verified for life. From that point onwards, you will continue to receive 35% off through Thorn. Now, for those of you who don't qualify, there is still the 10% off using the code BTS10, behind the shield 10, for a one-time purchase. Now, to learn more about Thorn, go to episode 323 of the Behind the Shield podcast with Joel Totoro and Wes Barnett. This episode is sponsored by a company I've used for well over a decade, and that is 5.11. I wore their uniforms back in Anaheim, California, and have used their products ever since. From their incredibly strong yet light footwear to their cut uniforms for both male and female responders, I found them hands down the best workwear in all the departments that I've worked for. Outside of the fire service, I use their luggage for everything and I travel a lot, and they are also now sponsoring the 7X team as we embark around the world on the Human Performance Project. We have MRF coming up in May, and again, I bought their plate carrier. I ended up buying real ballistic plates rather than the fake weight plates, and that has been my ride or die through MRF the last few years as well. But one area I want to talk about that I haven't in previous sponsorship spots is their brick and mortar element. They were predominantly an online company up till more recently, but now they are approaching 100 stores all over the US. My local store is here in Gainesville, Florida, and I've been multiple times. And the discounts you see online are applied also in the stores. So as I mentioned, 5.11 is offering you 15% off every purchase that you make. But I do want to say, more often than not, they have an even deeper discount, especially around holiday times. But if you use the code SHIELD15, that's SHIELD15, you will get 15% off your order or in the stores every time you make a purchase. And if you want to hear more about 5.11, who they stand for, and who works with them, listen to episode 580 of Behind the Shield podcast with 5.11 regional director, Will Ayers. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show Irish builder, firefighter, and poet, Jared Devine. Now, with this being St. Patrick's Day, I felt that this was the perfect time to air such a powerful conversation. So we discuss a host of topics, from his early life, building houses in both Ireland and the US, his journey into the fire service, paramedicine in Dublin, his pilgrimage in Spain, volunteering in Africa, and to round off this incredible conversation, he reads one of his poems, The Firefighter's Call. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single five-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of over 900 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Jared Devine. Enjoy. Well, Jer, I want to start by saying two things. Firstly, thank you so much to Peter Conroy, who we'll talk about in a minute, for connecting us. And secondly, to welcome you onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Yeah, thanks very much, James. Yeah, delighted to be here. It all came about through Peter Conroy, one of my colleagues in the Dublin Fire Brigade. So I love your show. I love what you're doing. So delighted to be here.
So as an icebreaker, I told you this was going to go out on St. Patrick's Day. It's funny how the universe kind of makes these things happen.
Yeah.
And then we are both holding a pint of Guinness, which is so cliche, but this is actually quite a pertinent drink for you and your personal life and your family. So talk to me about the connections with your father and your wife and the pint of Guinness.
Okay. Ah, that tastes good. So, yeah, well, my father, from the center of town, and when he was 14 years of age, he started working in Guinness's, and he remained there for almost 5 decades. And he remembers he was 14 because he got his first pair of long pants, and he started in Guinness's. Yeah, and he loved it. He worked hard, but even growing up, like if we were drinking any beer or anything like that, we'd be kind of persuaded, no, listen, hang on, Guinness pay my wages, so you drink Guinness, you know, that's it. Like, so we'd no options. And actually, even when wasn't that long ago, with newborn babies, the mother would be given like a glass of Guinness because of the iron in the Guinness. It was considered good for them. So and then I'm just trying to think, well, yeah, my wife Steph, she was working in a bar in town when I met her. And they were just closing the bar, and any chance of a Guinness, we were only arriving, me and my pal, so she let us in, and she just poured me the most perfect pint of Guinness, and I was just in love, you know. I was like, man, this girl's amazing. You know, so that was what qualities do you look for type thing. But and I was trying to chat her up, and I was getting nowhere, you know. I don't think she was interested, but I even then, you know, what do I work as? And I said, the fire brigade, still nothing. I was like, oh, man, this is tough.
But is wrong with this woman?
Yeah, man, come on. I mean, more than you want. And, but then I literally had just got my dog, Saoirse, she's a rescue dog. And once she heard that, the tune changed, like, because she's an animal lover and she loves dogs. And then that was great, like, you know, so... But I was trying everything. I told her I had a pickup truck. I told her I worked in the fire brigade, you know, nothing. But once I mentioned the dog, that was good. It was a good start, you know. So, 10 years later, we're together. We're married now, so we still have the dog. She's hanging in there.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Yeah. I have to thank Guinness for a lot, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an interesting kind of start to the conversation. Yeah. So obviously by your accent, you're not in South Carolina. So tell people where you're sitting right now.
Yeah, so at the moment I'm over in Ireland. And I know this is going out on Paddy's Day, so it's probably a lot of Irish people listening, hopefully, on a day when everyone's Irish. But I'm in a place called Wicklow. I'm from Dublin, and I work for the Dublin Fire Brigade, but I'm in a place just outside Dublin. We moved out here about 5 years ago. So I don't know if you see there, a lovely house on the hill, and a lot of trees, a little bit of land, deer come into the garden, red squirrels, pine martens. It's great because where I was, it was city. I was always a city boy. I mean, I came up here, I never owned a lawnmower before. And then, you know, now I have like, you know, now I have about 5 axes, you know, that type of way. So it's a big change, but it's a nice change, and it's fantastic for my headspace, and you know, just to be, I'm away from where I lived before. I was kind of beside the hospital, so you just hear the sirens, you know, from the ambulances, you know, up and down the street at night. There was no escape from it. Like, so up here, you know, you don't hear anything. You hear buzzards flying overhead and or maybe the odd helicopter, but other than that, we're on the side of a mountain looking down on a lake. House needs a lot of work, but we're getting there, you know. We're getting there. Luckily, there's no real pressure from the wife, you know. She loves it here too, so probably more than me, if anything, because she loves nature. And we're happy out.
It's interesting that you have those two perspectives, because it really blows me away that there's almost this perception that, you know, fire / EMS sit around doing nothing, you know, especially on the fire side, you know, waiting for a call. And I always point out, like, if you live in a city or a suburban area, just go outside your front door. What do you hear? You hear sirens all the time. And if you happen to be near a fire station or a hospital, then you're going to hear them even more. But the skewed perspective is, you know, where you are now, you could see how people are like, oh, they just sit around waiting for a call, because you're not seeing, you know, the immense level of responses that actually happen, especially in a city.
Yeah, I mean, Dublin, it's a busy city, and it's a growing city. It's growing outwards, but it's also growing upwards. You know, we've a lot of high rise just in the last like 5 to 10 years have gone in, and every day, I mean, there's just cranes everywhere. You're being sent to addresses now, and they're not even updated on Google Maps. The city's growing that fast. So and we're just kept going constantly. We do the ambulance, and we do the fire side of things. So the ambulance is just 24/7. We cover each other for breaks, but the ambulance never sits in the station. Very, very seldom. You're just kept going from the moment you start. So the night shifts are tough going, and you're kind of eating food on the wing. But it's kind of what we signed up for. But sometimes, you know, a couple of hours sleep at night would be nice, you know, as regards when you work on the ambulance. But we just keep going, I guess, you know.
I distinctly remember being humbled by Pete, and it wasn't anything negative at all, but you talked about the fact that you have a combination of fire and EMS in Dublin specifically, even though other parts of Ireland and the rest of the UK, they're still two separate, you know, departments. And then I was like, oh, so, you know, how long ago did you go to the American model, knowing that our history goes back? Some people think it's the 70s, it's actually the 60s, and the Freedom House is the origin story of paramedics specifically here in the US. But it was way before that. So talk to me about the history of EMS and fire combination through a Dublin lens.
Yeah, so basically what they found is the best rate of survival, if you're going to have a heart attack or whatever, like I said, if you have the backup of a fire crew that's EMS trained, I mean, your rate of survival is just, it's just like, I don't know, percentage wise, I'm sorry, I can't give you any figures, but like the fact that every fireman in Dublin, every firefighter in Dublin, I should say, is a qualified paramedic. You know, so they can jump up, they can jump in the back of the ambulance, they can be doing CPR, you know, they can be administering drugs. So it's just a great resource to have. And also then, if the ambulances are busy and someone's having a stroke or even a heart attack, like we carry defibs and everything on the trucks. I'm sure most brigades do. But we're very qualified and well used to using the gear. And we pretty much have them almost wrapped up, ready to go as soon as the guys get there, the ambulance gets there. So, yeah, I'm not sure the exact date when they combined the two, but it's been going a long, long time.
I think Pete was saying it was the turn of the century, like late 1800s. And obviously, again, you know, paramedicine didn't look like it does now, but we were certainly in America, because I'm more familiar with their history, ironically, you know, our pre-hospital medicine was basically a hearse. You were either alive or you were dead. And then they started trying to keep them alive in the back of the hearse. And then obviously that evolved to ambulances and what we know now. But he was saying that, you know, the first versions of medical care combined with fire went back to, I think he said like 1892 or something. It was way before we had, you know, pre-hospital medicine.
I remember seeing records of like the 1916 Rising, which would be a famous event in Irish history. And you can see the ambulance records, you know, and you know these old school records, big books and beautiful handwriting. And it's like a volunteer was brought to St. James's Hospital suffering from wounds to the leg, suffering from a gunshot. In all these amazing records. And so that's like back in the early 1900s. Like, so, yeah, I'm sure it's definitely there longer than I've been around. just about.
Well, speaking of that then, so you mentioned that your dad, you know, spent his career working in Guinness. Tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic. So what, you know, the rest of your family did and how many siblings?
Yeah, so dad and mom both come from Dublin City. Dad's born in a place called Brunswick Street, which is basically beside the Liffey, on the north side of the Liffey. And mom is from the same area, kind of Manor Street. And then they would have moved out to Clontarf, which is not that far from the city centre, out beside the sea. Great place, lovely place to grow up. Like there's a nature reserve, Bull Island is a nature reserve, lovely beach on our doorstep, and St. Anne's Park, great place to grow. But it's walking distance from town, really. Like you often did it, if you couldn't get a taxi or no money for a taxi, you could walk home in, you know, maybe 45 minutes. And I have one older brother, my older brother Pat, he's a songwriter. Then there's myself, my brother John is a teacher. Kevin is web design, and then the youngest is my sister Helen, and she's a graphic designer. So yeah, five kids. What to tell you, dad's he played hurling. I said he worked in Guinness's. He played hurling, passionate hurler. He would have hurled with Dublin and Owen Rowe, who are a club from town. And my mother's father was the manager of the team. So she'd be brought to the games and end up falling in love with dad, or vice versa, whatever happened. And that's how they met, was through the game and the sport of hurling. And my family, it's called the Gaelic Athletic Games. We've Gaelic football and hurling and handball as well, actually. So they would have met through the GAA, and we were always raised as, we regarded as a GAA family, I suppose. We all played Irish games, Irish sports, and it stood to us, you know. I mean, we've a Gaelic football team in the Dublin Fire Brigade, and we actually have a hurling team this year in the Dublin Fire Brigade, and we've trips away, and it's great, actually. We've played against the New York Fire Brigade there last year, and that's pretty much it. A big little family, I suppose you'd call it.
When I was in school, you know, obviously football was really big, but I found myself playing hockey, field hockey. And when I think about it, it's not too dissimilar from hurling. Obviously, you can't pick the ball up and you know, hit it in the air so much. But I don't think people realize just how painful it is playing a sport with a stick and a ball that's not soft. You know, so it was pretty interesting, because it was, you know, kind of ridiculed as a quote unquote women's sport. But actually, I mean, you know, that kind of version of hockey, and I'm sure, you know, stepping up even more hurling, that's a pretty courageous sport to play, because it's not like you're wearing a bunch of pads, and the ball certainly, you know, isn't made soft, and neither is the stick that you're holding. So I've always got a lot of admiration for sports like that.
Yeah, it's a tough game for sure. Hurling is the fastest field game in the world. I think ice hockey is the fastest game in the world played on ice, but as regards played on in a field on grass, hurling is the fastest game. And only till recently were helmets made compulsory. And like in fairness, I would have worn a helmet, but I didn't always wear a face guard and a few marks and scars to prove it. When my dad played, there was no helmets, and he's got a lot of scars. And that was back in the days when you were stitched up, you were seldom given an anaesthetic. I've had a lot of injuries. One of my hands had a serious operation on that, and I've probably had about four operations, let alone like kind of fractures and broken ribs, that type of thing, from playing hurling. But it's a great game. It's something you're very passionate about, and I miss it now that I'm not playing anymore. But I got a fair whack out of it. I played into my 40s. I'm 48 now. Probably played my last game about 4 or 5 years ago. And I just couldn't catch the guys anymore. So time to pack it in, maybe, you know.
That's the thing. You can still be extremely athletic. I mean, I'm going to turn 50 in about 2 weeks' time. But you can't also deny the fact that even when you're probably doing well compared to a lot of people your age, you're not 20 anymore, and you start to see that gap kind of widening and widening, and it sucks.
Yeah. I remember when I started playing, you'd come up against the odd elf, like, and they'd be kind of turn a bit nasty, you know, they'd be slower and you'd get a late tackle or you might get a, you know, a crack across the ankle or the hand or whatever. And I remember saying to, turning to one guy, he hit one of our younger fellas, and I said to him, listen, pal, you need to pack it in, you know? And he was expecting a row, you know, because he'd hit one of my guys. But I just went, you need to pack it in, man. You're gone too slow. You know, you're getting nasty. And he looked at me and he kind of had a realization, like, and I never saw him since. So he kind of,
he probably burst into tears.
Then I was playing a match one time and a guy went by me, kind of not made a fool of me, but I just wanted to kill him, you know, kind of a bit of a nasty streak in me. And I was just like, right, it's time to pack it in, pal. If you start, you know, if that's going to be the way you're going to play, you know, lose your sportsmanship, it's time to call it a day, you know. So that's what I did, you know.
Yeah, that is, it's humbling. You know, it's your ego speaking. You know, I should still be beating that person. I've been playing it longer than that person, but yeah, that's just not the way life is. The body does, you know, not hugely, but you just, you know, slower and slower and not as strong and not as explosive as you were. And it shows. And younger people that have not been doing something as long will start beating you. And it's a humbling moment in middle age.
Yeah, true. And I'm the last to listen to that advice of, you know, people saying, oh, you're not getting any younger. And because I think that can be used as a cop-out for lads, you know, not going to the gym anymore. Oh, it takes too long to recover, or not going for runs and spotting the joints. And because, you know, there's some great athletes out there. Like, I just try and keep going as best I can. I train, probably the same as yourself. I kind of train for mental health, like, as well. It's just great. I feel sluggish if I'm not training, you know. So that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I think that perspective of understanding that you're slower, though, if you process it the right way, keeps you training. Because I think absolutely, people get discouraged, and if their ego gets in the way, well, fuck it, I'm not going to play anymore, this is stupid, you know. They keep, you know, beating me, rather than, all right, well, you know, I'm not catching that 22-year-old anymore, but let me refocus. And we'll get to some of the things that you're training for now in a minute. When you talk about mental health, as we sit here now in 2024, we are starting to really understand that it's not just what you and I saw in uniform, but what happened before we ever put the uniform on is a big part of our overall mental health story and journey. When you look back at your early life, were there any elements that contributed to any struggles later in life?
No, I was lucky. Childhood wise, I had a great childhood. I always played as a team. I had a big brother looking out for me. I had a few little things. I would have got beaten up once or twice as a, you know, like, but the local bully type stuff, you know, that way. Like, it was, would have been bigger and older than me or my older brother. Like, and it's amazing. I one guy in particular, like, I was probably about 12 at the time, and I remember just being tears in my eyes, and my pals were there, and there's nothing they could do. And I remember saying to them, like, you know, someday I'm going to be a big guy. I'm going to get him, you know. And I kept an image of this guy, like a lunatic. I kept an image of this guy when I'd be training, when I wanted to quit, you know, even say, you know, whatever it was, press ups, like, just keep going, anything. And trained, even learned how to box, thinking of his head on the bag, you know. And then it got to the stage where I was in, say, in my early 20s, you know, I met him, you know, and I didn't have to hit him, you know. I just scared, had a few words of him, you know, scared the look. He was just all apologies, you know, he'd no idea. But it's kind of like, I don't know, was it a, maybe it was a blessing in disguise, because it gave me a focus. It gave me something to, maybe it's not a great thing to aspire to be able to kick the shit out of someone, but, you know, it was a lot to be said for it. It was kind of, many movies have they made about stuff like that, you know, seeking revenge, and the montage of the guy training comes along. But I spent like at least 10 years training. So never to feel like that again, never to have, you know, to feel vulnerable that someone could just overpower me, you know. So but as regards you know, usual things, grandparents dying, pets dying, that type of thing. But nothing I didn't bounce back from, to be quite honest. I'm lucky in that regard. My dad is a very, very stoic man. You know, and my mother too. And they've had a few tragedies in their life, and they wouldn't even tell you about it. You know, it would be someone else or another relative would tell you about such and such what happened, and would have had no idea, because dad or mom wouldn't. Not that they're hiding it away, like suppressing it as such, but more that, life goes on, you know, that's just the way it was. A kind of a tougher generation in a lot of ways, and I guess a lot of that would have rubbed it off on me and my brothers and my sister. I'd like to think it has anyway.
Well, it sounds like they, and I don't know if I'm right or wrong in this, but it sounds like maybe they processed it properly, because I think this is a kind of misunderstood element of trauma, is if it's left unaddressed, then it simmers there. There's a Mexican proverb that I quoted in my book. They tried to bury us. They didn't know that we were seeds. And I love that. If you push it down, it's going to grow. However, I also, from a hope perspective, I truly believe that if you process trauma, that becomes strength, that becomes resilience. And so that is how you kind of stop the dominoes from falling on that kind of multi-generational trauma. So it sounds like maybe, you know, because if it had been buried down and buried down, that you'd probably be identifying things where it was affecting them. But if they had kind of, you know, the buck stops here, I'm not going to let that carry on into me raising my kids, then I think that's a really powerful perspective, because that's what we need. We need to deal with our own shit so we don't pass it on to our children.
Yeah, 100%. And I actually remember my, it was a time when people really didn't show their emotion. I didn't see men crying when I grew up. You know, I don't remember seeing my dad crying, maybe at a funeral, if even, you know. But I remember my granddad died, who was Jared, who I was named after, and his son, my uncle Jared. I'd say I was about 10 or 11. I was young enough. But I distinctly remember myself and my granddad were very, very close. Like, we used to go to his house after school every day, and we, you know, play in the garden, and he loved us, and he had a graph for me, a love for me, because I was, you know, I was named after him. So my uncle Jerry was a big, strong man, very, very strong man. Sadly, he passed. But I remember him bringing me out to the garage, and he's like, "Jerry, just come out here to me." And this is the day of the funeral, after the funeral. And he said, "Look, I noticed you haven't cried yet. You don't seem too upset, you know." And I was probably in shock. I was just a kid, you know. I didn't process the whole thing properly, but I hadn't cried. And he said to me, "It's okay to cry." And I said, "Yeah, no, I know. He goes, "Well, listen, men cry too, you know." I was like, okay, yeah, Grant. And he gave me a hug, and he says, "All right," and I realized, and I was only a kid, but I really remember this. He wanted me to cry so he could have a cry. And I remember forcing myself, because I didn't particularly want. And he had his few tears. He wiped them away. And then he said, "Now, we won't, this will be our secret. We keep this for ourselves." And then he drives up, and he's big chested, big strong guy, goes back into the afters, into the wake, you know, and no one knew. And he could go in going, "I was looking after little Jerry, you know." I let him have it. I never said it to him. And, you know, a great guy, a character. I miss him very, very much, actually. But, it was just a different generation. And there's a lot to be said for it. I mean, maybe some people get too upset too easy nowadays. You know, life is tough, you know. You're going to have... You know, as a young guy, you're going to have girls break your heart. You know, there's different things you're going to face, and you need to have a little bit of, I think, a bit of resilience, you know. I think, that's just my opinion on it, really.
I think where I see a kind of disconnect is gratitude. Because crying is an incredible human emotion. We literally do it the moment we're born, you know what I mean? So there's nothing bad about it at all. However, self-pity is a different conversation. And I think the less you feel grateful for, the more you feel like a victim. And I just shared a few things on social media recently. One of them was just now, Mark Coleman, UFC legend, rescued his two parents from a fire in his home and then went back in to try and rescue his dog, which is called Hammer, which is his fighting name. And he wasn't able to get it. Ends up being intubated because I'm sure he inhaled superheated gases. And they just shared a video like 2 hours ago of him extubated, and he's hugging his family and just is so grateful for his life, for having saved his parents, but then is also in tears about losing his dog. Like, those are raw, real emotions, you know. But I think what happens is if you also don't wake up and realize just how lucky you are to be born in Ireland, in England, in America, you know, and there's no war outside your front door, you know, and you've got food in the fridge and there's clothes to put on, then that feeds into that victim mentality, which is, I think, you know, what is diluting the very healing, positive mental health and men crying conversation, because we're surrounded by people that, you know, some people that burst into tears over everything these days because, you know, there is that entitlement and that lack of gratitude. So I think, you know, the pendulum hopefully will swing back to the middle where we have some grit and some resilience, but we're not afraid to cry when we need to cry.
Yeah, yeah. When you're saying we cry when we're born, I actually, when I was born, I seemed like I had a pint of Guinness and I got a taxi home myself, you know. But, no, you're right. I think it, like, I'm lucky that I've traveled a lot. I do a bit of volunteer work actually in connection with the Fire Brigade over in Africa. I do a bit of building work over there, and it humbles you. You know, you're seeing kids with great kids, and some of them will have sores on their face, and you know that poor kid has HIV, and when you come back next year, that kid's not going to be there. You know, so I've never taken for granted how lucky we were. I was growing up, you know, we weren't spoiled by any means, but we were spoiled when it came to love in the house. You know, it was a very, very lucky, like, but I appreciate that, you know. And don't get me wrong, I've shed a few tears here and there, like, but it's amazing the way different things, it's nearly as I get older now, I maybe becoming a bit more sensitive in my old age, but different things hit me, you know, different things that are unfair kind of hit me more, or, you know, when someone you lose. There was one of the guys in work there, he had a bit of a turn, he's okay now, and I remember just thinking how unfair it was. Like, there's a great guy, fit guy, looks after himself, and I was afraid you were going to lose him, you know, and luckily he didn't. But it's just heartbroken. I was just like, man, am I having a breakdown here or something? Like, I found myself on the couch with the dog after a night shift, just kind of tears in my eyes, thinking about, man, I can't, you know. There's a great poem, and no one's sure who wrote it. They some blame say it was a Scottish writer. There's, of course, the Irish, we claim it's Irish. So, but it's called Tell Him Now. And it's my dad's favorite poem, and it has had such an impact on my life. And I can't even recite it, but there's a few lines. It's basically, it finishes, a man can't read his gravestone when he's dead. So the gist of it is, if you think someone's great, or if you think someone's doing a great job or a great person, whatever, tell them. Because there's no point when they're, you know, standing over at the grave when they're gone saying, nah, he was such a great fella, or, you know, they were, you know. So it's something I've tried to do more and more often. If someone has been sound, or, you know, just let them know, because unfortunately you leave it too late and they'll never know. And it's a nice thing to do. You never know who can use a leg up or a boost from time to time. And sometimes I've done it once or twice, and a couple of months later I've got a phone call saying, Jerry, you didn't realize what that meant to me at the time. You know, I was actually in a bad spot, and out of the blue you just rang me saying, listen, man, I think you're a smashing fella. And it's a great thing to, it's not an easy thing to do. I think it takes guts to tell someone, you know, because they're like, are you okay? You know, is everything okay? And I say, no, listen, I'm 100%. I just want to let you know you're a legend. And they're like, okay. And eventually they get it, you know. And so I've tried, that's something I try and do from time to time, you know, so
There's a quote from, it's attributed to Anne Frank. It's sometimes you kind of think that someone said it for years and then all of a sudden the internet says, they never said that actually. But regardless, this is what it's supposed to have been said by her. The dead get more flowers than the living because grief is more powerful than gratitude.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. I think I've actually heard that before. Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah, it's a brilliant, but that's exactly what I'm talking about. You know, it's, just let them know, you know, it's kind of, you put your heart in your sleeve type stuff, but, you know, even, I've rung up the odd, manager that used to, look after me as a kid, you know, because all these guys are giving up their Saturdays, their Sundays, their midweek to train us for nothing. You know, there's no money in it for them. It's an amateur sport. And just to say, listen, just thanks. Thanks for that. And then a guy gave me a crack at the Dublin hurling team and rang him up years later and, you know, and just said, listen, like, just thanks for the opportunity. Like, you know, fair play to you. Like, you know, and he's not a bother, you know, you deserved it, whatever. I said, yeah, but even so, you're the only one that did it, you know. So just little things like that. And I had a pal there who passed away, a guy in my GA club, an older man. He's ex-army, tough as nails, lovely guy. And he wasn't well. And I rang him up. And I don't think he could take it. But I just told him what I thought of him, you know, the regard I held him. And I was just delighted I got to say those things to him, you know, before he passed on a few months later. Like, but yeah, it's about being grateful, isn't it? Really, that's what it comes down to.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, speaking of poetry, obviously we'll get into, you know, your writing currently, but when you were in school, were you already kind of diving into poetry or writing?
No, come here, diving in. I was trying to dive out of school, to be quite honest with you. I wasn't.
You and me both.
Yeah, I wasn't an A student. I was smart, you know, the usual brains to burn but doesn't apply himself type thing. And my brother Pat was very academic, and he went before me, you know, so that was kind of always in his shadow. But I loved maths, I loved art and that, but I actually had dyslexia, which wasn't discovered until I was probably about, I'm not sure, maybe late primary school. But even then, there was no dispensation for it. You didn't get extra time in exams or anything like that. But what I did get, I got some lessons from people who understood it, like some English teachers, and that really brought me on. But I look back at some of my old things I used to write, and like just putting letters backwards and stuff like that, which is, I don't suffer from that anymore, thank God. I don't think you can kind of get over dyslexia, which is something you're always going to have, but you can learn to deal with it. It doesn't really affect me now, day to day. And then it's seen now as actually, because I'd written a poem about it and Dyslexia Ireland were like all over it. But then in my description of the poem, I described it as a demon. And they were like, no, you can't say that, a demon, because seemingly that's a bad word now, you know? And I'm like, well, I'm not changing it, because to me it was a demon. It held me back, even everything from, I don't know, even I don't sound silly, but like even in relationships with girls and that, like, because sooner or later you're reading menus or she wants you to read her horoscope or that, and you'd be fucking nervous as hell. Like, so, but yeah, like, I mean, I did, you know, I obviously got into the fire brigade, I went to college, but I just had to work harder at it. And I never really enjoyed reading. But like, there's so many gifted people, like Einstein, even my favorite poet, Yeats, is dyslexic. So there's a string of them, you know, Richard Branson, Muhammad Ali. They're seeing it. You just have a different way of looking at things. And actually, since doing the poetry, I'm only doing the poetry the last couple of years. The amount of people I've spoken to that are poets and said, I'm dyslexic as well. Like, you know, you have a different way of looking. And it's nothing to do with your writing, your vocabulary. It's your turn of phrase. It's the way you look at things. So in a way, I've a great advantage in that regard when it comes to poetry.
Brilliant. Well, I know that you went into the building industry before you entered the fire service. So you're in school. Walk me through your journey into that side.
Yeah, I would have always, I would have always been doing kind of building work, especially carpentry and tiling, that type of thing, and then worked in sports. But there's no money in sports. There was no, you know yourself growing up, there was very few gyms. If they were gyms, they were like spit on the floor gyms that were just full of the bouncers, you know, just big steroid guys. You wouldn't have athletes per se in them. So, maybe knock that off, sorry. But yeah, I got into the building trade, and then I was working away doing that, lifting blocks, doing carpentry, doing everything really. I worked for a small kind of builder, and we basically did everything. We dug the foundations, and we put the chimney cowls on from start to finish, and we did the decorating, the tiling, did the whole lot, building houses. And then I would have spent time in the States, and I was like that. I was doing framing, I was doing roofing, concreting, and that was tough work. I've done a lot of tough jobs, but concreting in California in the heat, you know, just using a jackhammer, and you're there with like just watching like your sweat drip off you, like just trying to get water into you. And I did roofing in Boston, and geez, that was tough going. I remember I was about 19. Eight of started on a Thursday, and I was the only one that went back on the Friday. That's how tough it was.
What got you to America? How did you get over there to work?
I was brought over playing Gaelic football, actually, and playing hurling. So you'd be brought over for the summer, and it was great because you'd get your flights and accommodation paid for, and all you got to do is, you know, play ball, and then they get you work as well. So I spent three summers in Boston, and then when I was in Boston, I'd be flown down to New York probably every second Sunday to play a match down there in Gaelic Park or Van Cortlandt Park. You'd just be flown down for the day, play a game, get a couple of quid, come back. Then I went to San Francisco to play over there, play hurling over there and football. And then I just fell in love with the place there, and I ended up staying there for a while. And then I ended up coming home. I came home because I got the fire brigade, to be quite honest. I'd done the exam, and then next thing I got called for an interview. So there was I had no phone over there at the time. So my mom knew I'd probably be in the Irish bar where I used to work. I used to do the door in the Irish bar, a place called Stephen's Green. And they rang the bar Sunday morning. I was there having my breakfast, and I had to get home. You're after getting an interview for the fire brigade. And I was like, oh God, you know, cause I was over there. I was kind of set up as best I could be, you know, and the car and the girlfriend and this and that. But I came home, and I arrived back in America, or back in Ireland rather, from California the day before my interview. I kind of had my hair bleached, long and kind of bleached white, kind of blonde. Shaved my hair off, number one all over, borrowed a suit off my brother, and just went in for the interview, like, totally kind of unprepared.
You must have had the best tan of any candidate that walked through that door.
Yeah, I had a great tan, and it was going okay. I had a guy interviewing me, kind of a well-known character in the Dublin Fire Brigade, though I've never met him since, a guy called Wadji. That was his nickname anyway, but he had a big strong guy, and he had an old kind of Indian ink tattoo on his forearm. And he's saying, I see you played football in Boston for Colin Kills. And I was like, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Did you, were you there yourself? And he goes, I was there in 83 with the fire brigade. And I was like, oh, geez, great, isn't it? And where did you go out? And he's kind of looking at me going, oh, listen, is this an interview? You can't have a chat. And then he said to me, he said, soldier, do you think that, being physically strong and physically fit has a major role to play in being a firefighter? And I was totally unprepared, you know, so I was just kind of went, well, yeah, I said, I hope it does. I said, it's my best asset. And he just started laughing. They all started laughing, just shook their heads going, all right, okay. You know, but anyway, whatever happened, it worked, you know. So I was luckily I had a lot of experience, you know, playing as a team, working as a team, that type of thing. So that stood to me.
And the construction background too, was that valued? I mean, you know, when I went to California, worked as a firefighter, I mean, the depth that we had to understand building construction, especially on the truck companies when we're standing on those roofs and cutting, was pretty intense. And a lot of the people that were, you know, older than me had that construction background. They were usually the ones teaching us. So how was that viewed, your actual hands-on experience when it came to you as an applicant?
Yeah, it was. And then in particular, when I started, like you'd be going into a, remember like going into a building before, and they, I think it was apartments. And I think it was a post fire or somewhere, trying to, the boss wanted the ceiling taken down. And he, I was like a junior man, he's like, going, yeah, get the ceiling hook. And I'm looking at him with a ceiling hook. Like, cause all you do pretty much with a ceiling hook, in my opinion, is punch holes in it, you know, it has its job, but. I said, I might grab a shovel if that's okay. And I don't know if you've tried taking down a ceiling with a shovel, it's so much faster. I was taking them down in slab. I think I was in one room, and I was like, I came out of it like, you know, 2 minutes later, I'm finished. Where and they were looking at me, what? They'd like had a little square all, like, you know. So, but even stuff like when it came to even heating systems, you'd have an idea of how things work, you know. And then I actually, recently enough there, I did building services engineering in college, and that's helped me a lot, you know, because it's all solar, all that type of stuff, you know. So having I'm not an expert by any means, but just having an idea of how things function, how a household, you know, ventilation systems, all that type of thing, and buildings and that. But I mean, it's a resource, you know yourself. I mean, if you're on the truck and you're going to something, an electrical fire, and you could very well have an electrician sitting in the back of the truck, you're going to use that, you know. So definitely useful and valued, I guess.
Absolutely. I was blown away. In California, they use what's called rubbish hooks. So rather than a pipe pole, it's this kind of fork that's probably 6-7 inches wide, and it's got two prongs. And so when you punch through the ceiling, and obviously it's drywall here, those prongs grab the piece and almost the whole freaking slab comes down the first time. So again, you know, right tool for the job, depending on obviously what the construction is of that building. But and I'm sure those came from people that understood construction. And were like, well, if we were going to remove this piece, this is the tool we'd use. We wouldn't use that little tiny hook for, you know, plaster and lathe, for example. We'd use this massive hook. So yeah, I wouldn't have been the person to go to, but I think that's what, you know, when you're talking about diversity in the fire service, I think that's the real valuable conversation. Of course, we need to have all of the people that are in the communities reflected in, you know, in uniform, but diversity is also, you know, who's good with animals, who can speak these languages, who's got the construction experience, so that within a station, hopefully you've always got a go-to man or woman that's the expert in that field.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've got in our crew, and he worked with lifts and elevators, you know, and he's just so knowledgeable, you know. He just know, you know, because how many times are you going to go to someone stuck in a lift? I mean, the guy's great to have, you know. And then I'm just trying to think of some of the professionals. We had all sorts of guys. One guy used to deliver coal, you know. Another guy's ex-army, you know. He's very, you know, physically strong, great guy, you know. So everyone brings their own, and I think actually some people forget that, you know, the biggest resource we have is ourselves, you know, like, and especially if you get an officer on transfer who's not familiar with the crew, they don't know, they don't ask sometimes who have we got, anyone, any experience in this, you know. You could be going to a, I'm trying to think of something, but, you know, you could have someone that's an expert in that field that you're going to, you know. So, it's definitely worth it.
I've seen people discount experts on calls. You know, and I'm talking about the, you know, you go to a facility, well, the people that work there are going to be the experts in that thing. And they're kind of like, you know, shushed. We got it. We'll handle it. And I remember standing there like, this is the person, like you said, that's an expert in the lift or this warehouse that we're going to or the paper mill or whatever it is. And so, you know, having the humility to ask the people at the place that you're going to, the expert might not be on your crew. There might be someone that called 911 that you can use as a resource.
Yeah, 100%, you know. And yeah, just little thing, you know, if you're used to being around tools, or, you know, you're going to be more like, I consider myself very comfortable with tools. I use consoles every week, you know, because I'm working in my own house here. And even today I was up scaffolding, you know. And so I think there's horses, don't get me wrong, anyone could be trained on something. But like, say if two guys are going for, say, an MER course, you know, a marine emergency response unit, and one guy is an expert swimmer and the other guy can't swim, you know, I'm gonna lean towards the guy that can swim. Or if I'm doing a high rise, trying to put a high rise team together, and one guy's an ex scaffolder, I'm gonna lean towards that guy, you know. There's guys and girls there who are coming in with great experience, and maybe sometimes it can be overlooked, but generally a good scout, if you like, will spot the talent and use it. That's the important thing.
Absolutely. Well, walk me through what it was like for you as a new recruit. You talked about being paramedics and obviously having the fireside. So what does that educational journey look like for a brand new recruit in Dublin Fire Brigade?
Yeah, so we would have been in the training centre for 6 months. And in that time, we would have done our paramedic training as well, which I found the toughest, because there was a lot of reading involved in that. And it was quite tough, and it's actually got tougher. I mean, the amount of drugs we would have to know has, I mean, at least doubled, if not quadrupled nearly. We had new recruits coming out now. But I would have been sent up to a station called Finglas. Finglas would have been a one-pump station. In other words, we had one ambulance and one truck. It would have been quite a busy station as well, which is a great place to serve your apprenticeship. So there was flats there, these flats called the Ballymun flats, and they would have been, you know, concrete floors, concrete walls, concrete ceilings, and we were getting a lot of fires in them. Some of them were derelict, but I mean, it's just literally like going into a pizza oven. But my first time going into one, I was going in one of the senior guys, and he said to me, grab there, and he put my hand onto the back of his set, and I'm kind of, I wasn't shown this, you know, this I'm supposed to, you know. And he's there, you grab there and don't let go. Do not let go and stay, you know, stay there. And I'm like, okay. So we did, and we put out a fire, and couldn't see anything, black with smoke. And then he said, right. He brought me in afterwards, and he showed me, we were probably about 7 stories up. The window, which wasn't there anymore, was only about a foot off the ground. So I could have, you know, and it was a Mickey Mouse fire, it was a derelict, but you would have, I'd like to think I wouldn't have, would have used my search procedures, but there's a good chance it could have gone out that feckin' window, you know, for pretty much a nothing fire. And he knew that, and that's why, just the experienced guy knowing what to do and showing me why we do it. And then, of course, when it came my turn to show him the new guy, I did the exact same thing. But it was a great place to learn, very busy, close to a lot of motorways. So we got a lot of car crashes, that type of thing. And then, of course, we would have come across, unfortunately, a lot of suicides, that type of thing. And unfortunately, all ages, young girl one time, you know. And different things like that. Very, very busy. You were watched out for. I was only in the job a couple of weeks. I would have came across a very bad incident with involving a baby, and it was a bizarre scenario, and something I had to deal with, and I did my best, but anyway, the baby was dead, but there was no one on my crew who had dealt with this particular thing. They'd been to cot deaths and whatever, but they didn't have to do what I had to do at the time, so there was no one really to advise me, but they just kept an eye on me, like, you know what I mean, made sure I was okay. So that was my first introduction. Like, I was only in the job like 2 weeks, operational 2 weeks, and I'm there, man, this is tough going. But I was happy in the fact that, possibly because I was just fresh out of training, that all my CPR procedures at the time were like spot on. I was on the money. So there's I, I gave the kid whatever chance I could, you know. But yeah, so it was a real eye-opening experience. And then from there, I was sent into the control room, where I spent 3 years in there. And then you see another side of the job. I didn't particularly like the control room, but I got to see a different aspect of the job. I would have preferred to have been out on the... You still are rotated out, you know, to keep your skills up, and so especially you have to keep your skills up on the ambulance and stuff like that. So whenever there's an opportunity to be rotated to the outside, if you like, I would always jump on that, you know. And but that's pretty much it. I think I'm 18 years in just about a week ago, March, 6th of March. So yeah, I still have a grow for the job, you know, I still enjoy going to work, which is the main thing. So
the control room, would that be what we call the dispatch center here? People answering
999 calls? The exact same thing. Yeah.
So I've asked this, funny enough, quite a lot recently, but I've had dispatchers on the show. What was the interesting contrast that you witnessed or experienced between the voice on the radio that some of us sometimes get impatient with when we're actually in the stations versus being that voice and taking the calls?
Yeah, it's tough going. This might sound strange, but it's a very, very stressful environment. And I wasn't really prepared for that. I mean, you could have an elderly person ringing you, and an elderly lady ringing you, and their husband's had a heart attack. And a lot of the questions, although it's a proven system, but a lot of the questions are yes or no. You know, like, is that person breathing? And someone comes back to you, I don't know. You got to get that answer. You know, people are in shock. They're in panic, you know. And it's not a very, I don't know what the word is. I'm not going to say humane, but it's not a natural conversation, if you like. And sometimes you have to kind of deviate, I think, from the regimental yes or no, black and white type questions. And you can get in trouble for doing that because, well, you've something going with it, you know. But I mean, when people aren't giving you, they don't know, people are in panic, you just kind of, the human side of things has to come in, and you have to kind of nearly, I don't know how to explain it really, but yeah, it's stress. It nearly plays on your mind more, you know, when you hear bad calls coming in. I mean, one of the guys got a call and help, my boy's got a knife, she's going to stab me, blah, blah, blah. And then next thing you hear the knife going in, you know, this is like, so he kind of listened to a murder, you know, so like that's bizarre. Like, you wouldn't wish that on anyone. And then there's the good calls, which would be considered where you've given CPR over the phone and they've, you know, the person has survived. And then you can hear in the background the lads arriving on the ambulance or the fire truck taking over, you know. And you're going, okay, I hear the lads there now, I'm going to leave you to it. Okay, thanks, you know. So, just a different side of things. But I was surprised on how stressful a situation it could be. I think it's because you're kind of helpless in a way. You know, it's like being at a football match and being a sub. You want to get on there and do something, but you can't really. You know what I mean? You can do what you can. You know, like, you can shout and cheer the lads on, but you can't really have an impact as such. And that's how I felt when I was in the control room. In that regard, I didn't think it was for me. But having said that, a great experience. I learned how the other side works. You know, sometimes why am I being sent to this? Why are we being sent to this? This isn't our area. Such and such should go to this. You understand why. You know, a tough enough job, actually. So
it's interesting listening to, you know, some of the dispatchers and some of the people that had to do dispatch during their career. And it's the same as some of the California law enforcement agencies. They have to go to corrections first, so they work in the jails before they ever go into the streets. But as you said, I think one of the observations from hearing all these is, you know, firstly, some of these longer shifts, I mean, these dispatchers arrive at, you know, when it's either early morning or late at night. So they arrive in darkness, they're in darkness all day looking at screens, then they leave in darkness. There seems to be a common denominator about the stress of not knowing the outcome of these calls, because I mean, it's hard enough for us responding to know, you know, the doctors and nurses and stuff, do they tell us if they died, they make it. But then the big one that really stands out is if you and I go on a call and we go to that cardiac arrest, well, we're bagging, we're doing CPR, we're picking the patient up, we're loading them. So there's a physical exertion. But the dispatcher that heard the murder, that's what they're still sitting in a chair. There's no physical offload to kind of flush the body of the cortisol and the other hormones and stressors.
Yeah, absolutely. And you say there about the physical end of it. So the fitness part of it comes into play as well. I mean, to say like sitting is the new cancer. You're sitting at a computer, staring into a screen. And when you're used to, well, for me, it was coming from an active background before I came into the fire brigade, and you know, and the fire brigade itself is, you know, it's physically demanding. And next thing, you're to me, you're like, want for a better word, like a desk job, and I didn't enjoy that end of it. Now, having said that, it's a great way if you were to get injured, you know, if you were to maybe have a long-term back injury or something like that, or hurt yourself and you're not fit to be on the fire ground, you can go into the control room, you know. So we would have some of the walking wounded would be in there, and or else some of the senior men that just don't want to be you know, doing the long nights on the ambulance. You can go into the control room, you know, because you know it takes your toll on your body. So maybe it's the better option. And but you can fall into bad habits. You know, you have to keep an eye, I think, on your diet and your mental health. Like, make sure you're staying active and keeping the body moving, keeping the mind moving. It's like you said, it's there's no escapism. You know, you're just in a room with other guys with your headset on taking calls, and every call is a distress call. There's no one ringing up to, you know, to tell you good news. There's
wish you happy birthday.
Yeah, it's just always bad news, you know. So, yeah, it's tough going.
So I want to move forward to poetry, but before we do, you mentioned 18 years now in the Dublin Fire Brigade. When you look back, what are some of the career calls? I mean, they doesn't have to be a big fire or anything, but what were some of the memorable calls when you reflect?
Yeah, there's some kind of, I guess, kind of been to a lot of different things. I suppose there's one in particular when I was actually on the ambulance and we were sent to a domestic fire, and we were pretty close to it. And we got there ahead of the fire truck. So me and my pal, we're there in our Navy combats, Navy shirts, and there's people outside, you know, and they're screaming like, there's people in there, you know. We're like, you're kind of going, I don't see you running in, you know, that type of way. It's like, it's expected of us. And we kind of looked at the eaves and we figured it was already kicked. We looked into the letterbox, the door was locked, kicked in the door. And like, we obviously took a bit of risk, but we kind of knew we were both capable. And I remember there was one woman on the stairs in front of us. I figured she was okay. And we went into a room then, and there was two women in there. So I went for the furthest woman. It was pretty waxed by. I had to hold my breath. And I picked her up, carried her out. And that was, and as I'm carrying her out, the fire truck arrived, you know. So like, basically a snatch rescue, which can be frowned upon, but like we did the business and we're happy enough with it. And so we saved the ladies, but we brought them, actually we brought that woman to the hospital, and we were hanging around. She was getting treated for smoke inhalation and stuff. And next thing, this guy arrived, and I kind of recognized him. And it turns out he came up to me and he goes, you saved my mother from that fire. I heard it was yourself. And I was like, no bother. And we were looking at each other. And it turns out we were in school together. We weren't great mates or that, you know, but we were in art class together. And he's like, Chair Devine. And I said, no, Lawless. Yeah. He was, he'd gone into the army. And he just starts laughing. He goes, I don't know what to say, pal. He says, last time we saw each other, I think we were getting thrown out of art class. And now you're after saving your mother from a fire. And we just had a hug, you know. It's just, well, I suppose the world, it's a small world, but Dublin is such a small place, you know. But I hadn't seen that guy in whatever, you know, 15 years. So that was kind of a nice story, like, but had a nice outcome. But, I don't know, loads of different things. This is usual thing when you're asked to tell a joke and you can't think of a joke.
Yeah, I am terrible at jokes. I butcher them anyway, so.
Yeah.
Well, with that scenario for a second, something that jumps to me in the US here when we're on what we call the rescue. So it's the ambulance, but we also have SCBAs and our bunker gear and some tools in there as well. So when you're assigned to the ambulance, there's no fire gear on that vehicle?
Okay. We wouldn't. We'd carry fire extinguishers and not really. No, you wouldn't. No, you wouldn't be expected. It's to be honest, pretty frowned upon. At the time when I did that, it was okay. You're told, you know, you weigh up the odds, you know, but really you shouldn't be committing yourself. But to be honest with you, we could hear the sirens. You know, we knew the lads weren't too far away, so it was well worth the risk. But generally the ambulance, we'd always send an ambulance to a domestic fire, you know, even if there's no one injured, they'd still be on the PDA to be sent. So, but generally, no, you wouldn't be expected to do that under any circumstances nowadays.
Right. I want to hit one more area before we go to poetry. Talk to me about Camino de Santiago.
Oh yeah, the Camino de Santiago. So that's it's a walk. It's a pilgrimage, an old pilgrimage, and like any good Catholic pilgrimage, there has to be a fair amount of pain in it. So the thing is that you walk to this there's different routes, but the route I did is you start in France, and you walk across. It's just over 800 kilometers. I think it's 820 kilometers to the town of Santiago. And I'm not sure the tradition, it dates back where I think prisoners used to have to go, they were released, but for a penance, they used to have to go to the coast and get an oyster shell and bring it back, the oyster shell, to prove they've been to the coast. It was kind of like a punishment type thing. I could be getting that completely wrong. But anyway, I had decided I wanted to do this with time off work. I'd built up a few weeks and... So I was in town with the guy who does my tattoos, my friend Tommy, in Classic Ink. And I said, listen, I'm going to do this walk across Spain. He goes, what are you talking about? I said, yeah, I'm going to go next week. I'm going to go to Spain. I'm going to walk across Spain. And he goes, as far as that, I said, well, in total, because I'm going to walk out to the coast, it's going to be like 1,000 kilometers. And he's like, geez, man, that's insane. I was there, that's just walking, you know. And a guy walked by in a suit, a lovely suit with an umbrella and a briefcase. And he goes, I dare you to do a dress like that. And I was like, what? And he goes, go on, I dare you. And I was like, all right, so yeah. So anyway, long story short, I did. And as it turned out then, it got a bit of traction. I ended up getting one of our top designers, like Louis Copeland. Like he kind of designs or tailors suits for the stars. He gave me a suit, like this lovely, it was lovely, it's not anymore, a black pinstriped suit. And I had an umbrella, you know, with the twirly handle, and I had a briefcase. But the problem with the briefcase is I couldn't bring any luggage. I couldn't bring a sleeping bag. I think I'd like two pairs of boxers, two pairs of socks, and then two T-shirts, you know. So after the first night we walked, I met a fireman, a pal of mine, Bob Leggett. We wouldn't have known each other that well. I would have passed him in the corridors, you know, different shifts in Tara Street. And we spent, he's there, where are you staying tonight? I was there, I don't know, I have nothing organized, nothing booked. He's there, man, you have to have something booked, the places. So anyway, I ended up staying in a hotel that he had gotten. And when we arrived there, there was a woman there. She's like, where's your luggage? And I'm like, no, this is it, like a briefcase. And she was really kind of insulted, you know. I was like, Jesus, this isn't going well, like, you know. So she was kind of giving out to me. So this is a serious thing. This is a serious pilgrimage. And, you know, you need to, this isn't a game, blah, blah, blah. So I'm there in a pair of shorts and flip-flops. And I was like, I turned to Bob. I said, that didn't go well. And he goes, geez, can't wait for the morning when she sees you in a suit. So, but she ended up, she was lovely. Like, and but we started walking and I think we did about 30K, but I had to go on and do about another 10K because I was tight on time. So like my average distance was 42 kilometers a day. But after the first night, I remember saying, now I was flying fit at the time. I said, this isn't physically possible. You know, I'm not going to be able to do this, to carry the suitcase and that. It's just like, you think carrying a suitcase, not a bother, and it isn't, or a briefcase rather. But after a mile or two, and after 10 miles, after 20 miles, you know, it's just ridiculous. So I did everything. I threw out like my handbook. I just pulled the maps out of it. I had a Swiss Army knife. I used my finger. I cut my hair, cut my toenails, cut my nails, cut the ends off my laces. Any excess weight I had, I just got rid of. Threw out my t-shirt, my spare t-shirt, threw it. You name it. I cut the end off. I was wearing a shirt and tie. I cut the end off my tie to make that lighter. Anything I could do. I squeezed out my toothpaste, half it. And then I realized, the tube is kind of the heaviest part of it. So I had a bit of cling film, like a little bag. I squeezed the rest of it into a cling film bag and rolled it up. So I had a little bag of toothpaste. I cut my toothbrush in half. Everything I could think of, you know, trying to be. And then, but I did it. But the only problem was I looked like a bit of a lunatic, especially after the suit got a bit tattered. And I go to some places and I try and get accommodation. And there was a few kind of head cases, I guess you'd call them, that just drift along the Camino, spent their lives drifting along the Camino. And I ended up actually befriended a few of them. But I looked like them and I couldn't get accommodation. So sometimes I'd have to end up walking through forests. That's true at nighttime and just to sleep rough once or twice and some nasty stuff like, but a great experience. I don't know if I would do it again. It was about 10 years ago now, but yeah, it was a good crack, good experience. So it's longer, because I was single at the time. I hadn't met Steph, but I kind of kept that quiet when I met her, because I'd say she would
marry me. Those weren't your match.com profile pics then?
Yeah. But I remember actually walking through I was like that. I got turned away from a hostel and I was told to go to the next town. And it was pretty dark. It was 10 o'clock at night. So you're just walking through by moonlight with no torch or anything. And I had to go through a trail through a forest. And in this forest, there were supposed to be wolves. Okay. And I'm like, now obviously you're walking during the day, there's no problem. But at nighttime, I'm by myself. So I'm there thinking, right, okay, don't get freaked out, you know, man up here. So I kind of devised this scenario, right, if I do get faced with a wolf, like I'm going to have a plan. So like you're tired, you're hungry, you're sore, you've blisters, everything. So the mind plays a few tricks on you. And I was there thinking, okay, if I'm faced with a wolf, I'm going to look it in the eye and I'm going to give it a chance to befriend me. And I said, and if it does, well and good. And we'll walk into the next town. I'll have my loyal wolf by my side. And I'm really like believing this, okay? I said, but on the other hand, if it jumps for me, I'm going to drive the point of my umbrella through its throat and kill it, you know? And I'm there, okay, grand. And so now I have my plan. I'm happy out. And I'm kind of using my umbrella as like a blind man's stick to make sure I don't walk into trees. That's how dark it is. And so I'm kind of looking in front of me. And next thing, I kind of barely make it out in the moonlight between the branches. There's like a little fluffy bunny rabbit ran across me and like nearly ran off my foot. And I almost shit myself. And I remember, leaning on my umbrella, kind of recovering from the fright and just kind of laughing and shaking my head, going like, I'm going to need a plan B if I meet a wolf, you know what I mean? Because
or a plan A for a rabbit. Maybe that was the problem.
Yeah, maybe I wasn't prepared for a rabbit. That was it, you know. But no, great experience. I met some great people. And Yeah, great stories. I actually kept a diary, and I should write about it really, because I kept a journal and did a few sketches, and I was given a dictaphone from RT Radio, who are like our national radio, to they wanted to kind of do a documentary on it, and I still had, so I interviewed a lot of people on the way. But when I came home, I did an interview for a different radio station, and so they couldn't use it then. I wasn't aware of this, but they gave me a copy of the thing. I still haven't listened to it actually, but yeah, I should maybe write about it in years to come. You know, it's on the list.
Well, I'm glad I asked that question. There's some pretty entertaining stories there. Well, speaking of poetry, so you mentioned about, you know, struggling with dyslexia when you were younger. Now you've got I'm assuming, if I got my timeline right, like 15 years or so in the fire service under your belt. Yeah. What brought you to the world of poetry? I mean, were you reading it first? And then what made you empowered enough to start writing yourself?
Yeah, so I actually got injured outside of work. I'd hurt my hand fairly badly, a dog bite actually, and I ended up going doing some ligament and tendon damage, and I went badly septic. And of course, when it happened, I did nothing about it. I said I'd just go home, and I was picking up scaffolding at the time actually, and had to get that home, and got that home, unloaded it, stopped for an Indian on the way, you know, the usual stuff. Did everything a paramedic should not do, if you like, picking up rusty scaffolding and stuff. And then, but the next day, I didn't sleep that night. My hand was in bits, badly swollen, and we were in work the next morning. So I drove into work. I wanted one of the advanced paramedics to see it, because I was trying to avoid this sitting in hospital all day, to be quite honest. And he was just like, man, that's bananas. You need to go straight away to hospital. And long story short, I sent from one hospital, I sent to a different hospital, and then I ended up in another hospital then for a week, and two operations on it. And I was fairly concerned about my job, about being able to work in my house. And someone had sent me, one of the girls in the job, actually, she'd sent me one of these, you know, you can listen to a poetry, you can listen to a poet, a guy, Stephen James Smith, a Dublin poet, very good. He does spoken word stuff. And I was listening to it, and I was like, oh, man, this is very good. And I used to write a little bit of poetry, maybe just messing around. And I was like, man, I'm going to start doing this. So I basically wrote my first poem lying in a hospital bed. Because I was kind of, you know, when you're in hospital, you don't sleep. I mean, the guy beside me, he was like groaning all night. And to be honest with you, I wanted to kill him. But then you got talking to him the next day. The poor guy's suffering from Crohn's disease. You know, you're like, Jesus Christ. You know, so you're like, you're not the worst. You're never the worst guy in the hospital, as they say. But yeah, I started writing then. And then I couldn't work. So I was just... Look, I was in the house here, just literally sitting on a rocking chair, just practicing, doing my physio, trying to move my hand, and then just writing. And it's like I'd had all these years of bottled poetry. I'd sent one or two of them to my brother, and he's like, you know, this is really good, Jerry. You know, you should send it to a guy called Michael McGlynn, who I used to give me grinds when I was a kid for dyslexia. We actually met up by chance over in Africa, small world stuff again. And he was like, look, Jared, this is really, really good. I'm probably a bit biased, but let me send this to a couple of English professors. And it just went from there. And then, you know, I just do this for sport. But I started, I kind of won a couple of competitions, started getting a little bit of recognition. And it's not that, but it's just that my poetry, I say for everyday people, like a lot of lads can relate to it, you know. So show it to a few of the guys in work, and they like it, and I might give them a copy of a poem. And then one guy in particular came back in the next day. He said, see this poem you gave me, I need you to sign it for me, the wife wants to put it on the wall, you know. So just little things like that. So but it's been tipping away now. And then the job actually asked me to write a poem for them, for the recruits passing out last year. And I, when I was asked to write it, it coincided with one of our senior men who had passed away, a guy called Paul Hand. And Paul was a real stoic guy, a bit of a legend, to say the least. And I couldn't make the funeral. We were on days, and I couldn't make the funeral. And I was a little bit upset about that, but I said a little prayer for him. And when I wrote this poem, I thought about Paul and kind of firefighters of his ilk, if you like, who I believe never really leave the fire ground. And I wrote the firefighter's call, and then I showed it to the guy Troy, who asked me to write, and he loved that it went through the ranks, through the training center, all the way up to the chief. And next thing, they asked me what I recited at the pass out, and then from there it kind of got a little bit of traction, and now currently we're selling the poem, and we're selling for, say, for 20 euros. I'm not sure what that is in dollars, but 100% of the money is going to the charity. It's a charity called Oscar's Kids, which deals with kids with terminal cancer. It's a wonderful charity, really, and it's one that's close to our hearts in the Dublin Fire Brigade. So a lot of these kids get inaugurated into the fire brigade. They're given their little certs, they're given their little uniforms, and it's a great idea. It's one of the guys, Stephen Cleary, it was his idea, and it's going from strength to strength. So we've raised a few quid so far, and hoping to raise a lot more. There's a lot of with you, James, like the likes of me being on this show now, if people maybe hear the poem and want to get it, I'm in the process of trying to set up my website that I can sell something from it. You know, I'm not great at that stuff, so I'm getting a little bit of help with that, but it's awkward enough. You can set up a website, which I've done, but to sell something from it, you need a kind of a business website, and there's a few ins and outs, and then all the money's going to charity, so that's a different kettle of fish. So at the moment, we're just selling it through the Dublin Fire Brigade, but like we've raised like over 1,300 euros so far, and say for Paddy's Day now, we're going to be the parade leads from Phibsworth Fire Station, and in conjunction with the Dublin Fire Brigade Whiskey Club, I'd be reciting the poem for the visiting brigades. So that's a nice honour as well. And also then on the 20th of March, next week, it's the 140th anniversary of the first Dublin firefighter that died, a guy called John Kite. There's a plaque going up on the street where he lost his life. And like the chief will be there, the Lord Mayor, one of the pipers from the band, and a guy called Lars Fallon. He's a retired firefighter, and he's also a fire brigade historian. Great guy. Great conversations with Lars. We talk for hours when we call each other. I send him over poems. He sends me bits of literature to give my opinion on. So, and I actually, that's one of my favorite things about the poetry. I'm kind of surrounding myself with these very creative people, and it's amazing. There's guys like in my job, like one guy, a guy Brian Hughes, he's like a champion Illan piper, who I always knew he was a musician, but not to this extent. You know, this. A lot of talent that just these guys are so modest, they just keep it to themselves, do their own thing, and you know, and it's great to be surrounded by just these creative people, because they pull you along, you know. It's like the same way, like if you're bad company, you can drag you down. I mean, good people pull you up, and that's what I'm liking the little journey so far, getting to do a few interviews. This is the highlight so far, I have to say, so thanks for that. I'm loving it, you know. And I write mainly about a few poems about the fire brigade related stuff, but a lot about my culture, you know, and my background. So I love that type of thing. I'm working on a poem at the moment. There's a guy called David Kyoman, and he's the ancient art of stone lifting, of all things, which is just, I'm just fascinated by this. It's it was like a test of strength, and it's big in Scotland and Iceland and actually kind of Japan, America, all over the world really. But it died out in Ireland because when the famine hit us, it seemed to coincide with that. So all the records of it were lost. But it used to be a test of strength. For example, now I'm just kind of rehashing what David has been preaching about. But say if you wanted to become a stonemason, there would be a rock, say probably maybe 70 or 80 kg, and you had to be able to physically lift that rock up onto a wall. And if you couldn't physically do that, you didn't get your apprenticeship. So it was a kind of a rite of passage to get your apprenticeship. It was also, there's like, we have rocks that are like 200 kg and only the strongest men from around could lift that, you know? And it's a great story. So meeting guys like that and, you know, getting in touch with fellas like that, I think it's just wonderful, you know? So it's enjoyable.
I was just looking, there's a female athlete that I saw lift, and this was two stones with kind of like metal handles, like, yes, driven into them. Yeah, Chloe Brennan, I think it is. I don't know where she's from. She's from the UK and or Ireland somewhere, but it's an amazing, and obviously the Icelandics have their, you know, version of the stones as well.
Odin stones or something like that.
I
think they're like 200, around 180 and 220. It's phenomenal. Like, I mean, that thing about the grip strength, I think she's the only woman to have done it, if I'm not mistaken. I watched the documentary on it. But David Kogan, actually, if anyone's listening, check this guy, Indiana Stones is what he goes by on Instagram. Like, it's just a fascinating story. And people were asking me, when am I going to write a poetry book? And I'm like, because I would have enough poems by now. And I was saying to David, I was like, listen, I might regret saying this, but there was an old Irish writer called Liam O'Flaherty, and he'd written a short story called The Stone. And it's about this stone that's out in one of the Aran Islands, which is a little island off Ireland, off the west coast of Ireland. And this elderly man revisits this stone, and he tries to lift it. And he actually dies, you know, trying, you know, he literally tries his heart out. But he's a frail old man, and he's just there, lying there dead. And the islanders come to collect his body, and they all talk about how when he was a young man, he lifted that stone up to his chest and he kissed it three times. And he was the only fellow on the island that could do it. And he was a legend. And they lifted him up on his shoulders and they carried him away. And long story short, through research and local knowledge, David discovered that this stone does exist. The woman just went, you know, I know this stone, because it was like a pink granite stone, which is unheard of for the area. But due to, you know, glacial erosion and everything like that, this was, would have shifted down onto the island. And he found the stone. And so the next thing he's there, like, this stone hasn't been lifted in 100 years, and he gets it. He gets the wind underneath it, as on Gwae Hifui, as it's said in Irish. And the rock is, it's about, I think it's 171 kg, maybe 177, I'm not sure. So people are saying, when am I going to write my poetry book? I said, well, I want my poetry book to be blessed by the old Irish writing gods, I said. So I'm not writing my poetry book until I can lift that rock. So I've set myself, and I said this to David, and of course Dave has the madness like me, which I love. He's just like, I love this, you know. So he says, I'll go with you, we lift it together, no bother to you and all this, you know. So that's one of my little goals now. So if I don't lift the rock, I'm not writing a book, I guess. So no pressure, but it's good. It's great to train for it, to be honest with you, you know.
Absolutely. Especially, again, you know, like, if you're not competing in sport anymore, but you are still a firefighter, that's what I always found is, you know, pick something to train for. I want to finish this interview, if you are up for it, with you reading the Firefighter's Call. So before we do that, for people listening, where are the best places to find you, your poetry, whether it's on websites or whether it's social media?
Yeah. So I just go by Jared at Divine Poetry, and you'll find me on Instagram, Jared underscore Divine underscore Poetry. Our, my website is jareddivinepoetry.com. And that's it. I'm on Facebook as well. So my website, it's a work in progress, you know, but at the moment it kind of links you towards my Instagram, but I'm hoping to have the firefighters call up on that very shortly if anyone is looking to get it. Because it's starting to travel. Actually, the first copy is in the Dublin Fire Brigade history, or the Dublin Fire Brigade Museum, excuse me. And then the second copy is over in number 10 station, which overlooks Ground Zero. There's a copy, actually, the lads from Talla Fire Station in Dublin are gone over to Boston for St. Patrick's Day. And they've brought over a copy of it, a nice presentation of it. And yeah, it's kind of starting to travel, and I hope it continues to. So it basically, that's where you'll find me, Jared Divine Poetry. You stick that in, my ugly head should pop up or something about me maybe, and you get me from there.
Brilliant. Well, I will give you the microphone then so you can kind of close this conversation out with your poetry.
Yeah. Thanks, James. It's called the Firefighter's Call, and it's about basically what calls us to the job, what's expected of us when we're in, and what happens when we're gone. It's not for fame or fortune that most deem necessary. No, I invest to don a crest for work less ordinary. Nor be it want of medals, cap or polished shoes, but a calling to help others who have everything to lose. To face hell's dancing angels and suppress them with each stride. To search resolve from deep within as loved ones weep outside. To stand with pride and dignity when comrades we remember, be it pipes lament that fills sad air or silence in September. And may those names that have been etched in brass or granite stone haunt me in the darkness so I never fight alone. And if a colleague's head hangs low from tasting tragedy, let me offer up my shoulder for them to lean on me. But when amazing grace is played, alas, for none but me, lower the flag, but raise a glass, for I'm not far from thee. I'm gathered with the old flames, looking down from God's great height, on call if aid be needed, to join you in the fight.
Absolutely beautiful, mate. Absolutely beautiful.
Hi, James. Yeah, I mean, when I listen to what I think of him, I think of Paul, obviously, but I think of my other pals that I've lost. And it's gas. You could be in the same station, and it depends what crew you talk to. They're going to think of someone else, you know. It's an unfortunate. Our colleagues become friends and often our best pals. And we think of these men and women, you know. It's the unfortunate thing about having friends is that you lose them along the way sometimes. And especially those that have gone before their time. So just wanted to pay a bit of respect to them. That's all.
Well, I think it's a beautiful way to pay respect. And this is the origin story of this podcast too, is, you know, we're all going to go one day, but it's when they go before they should have that it really, really stings.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to thank you so much. It's been such an interesting conversation, everything from walking through Spain in a business suit to, you know, some of the fire stories that you brought, and then obviously your poetry. So I just want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thanks very much, James. And as I said, I love the podcast, and wish you all the success, which I know you will have, because you're very dedicated to it. And it's I'm really honored to be asked and to talk here on behalf of myself and maybe representing my the Dublin Fire Brigade over here in this little corner of the world. So I'm happy St. Patrick's Day.